I want to continue now in volume 6, and I want to begin at April the 29th, 1904. The divine life manifests itself in souls through words, through works, through sufferings, but what manifests it more clearly are the sufferings. Continuing in my usual state, Louisa said, I found myself surrounded by three virgins who took me and wanted to crucify me on a cross by sheer force. How amazing. But since I did not see Blessed Jesus, fearing, I resisted them. On seeing my resistance, they told me, dearest sister, do not fear that our spouse is not here. Allow us to begin to crucify you, for the Lord, drawn by the virtue of sufferings, will come. That really should read, drawn by the power of sufferings. The thing that he's trying to tell us now is that suffering, voluntary suffering for love of God and in reparation for souls is extremely pleasing to God. So the Lord will be drawn by the power of sufferings and he will come. We are coming from heaven, they said. And since we have seen most grave evils about to happen in Europe, which of course is World War I, we have come to make you suffer so that at least they might be a little milder. In the meantime, they pierced my hands and feet through with the nails, but with such cruelty of pain that I felt I was dying. Now, while I was suffering, Blessed Jesus came, and looking at me with severe eyes, he told me, who commanded you to put yourself in these sufferings? Of what use are you to me then? To make me unable even to be free to do what I want and to be a continuous hindrance to my justice? In my interior, I said, what does he want from me? Neither did I want this. They have been the ones who induced me, and he gets upset with me. But I could not speak because of the bitterness of the pain. On seeing the severity of our Lord, these virgins made me suffer even more. Pulling the nails out and then driving them in again. And they brought me closer to him, showing him my sufferings. The more I suffered, the more it seemed that the Lord was appeased. And when they saw him more appeased, they almost moved by my suffering. Imagine the evils in Europe were so great that with Louisa going through this atrocious torment, it took time for the Lord to even accept it. So almost moved by my suffering, they left me and they went away, leaving me alone with our Lord. And then he himself assisted me and sustained me. And in seeing me suffer, to cheer me up, he said, my daughter, my life manifests itself in human creatures through words, through works, and through sufferings. So Jesus manifests his own life through in us and through us by our words, our works, and through sufferings. But what manifests this divine life more clearly are the sufferings. In the meantime, the confessor came to call me to obedience, but partly because of the sufferings and partly because the Lord would not leave me, I was unable to obey. So I lamented to my Jesus, telling him, Lord, how come the confessor is here at this hour? Why did he have to come right now? And he said, my daughter, let him be with us for a while and also let him participate in my graces. When one frequents a house continuously, he participates in its crying and in its laughter, in its poverty and in its riches. The same for the confessor. Has he not participated in your mortifications and privations? Now he participates also in my presence. And it seemed that he communicated divine fortitude to the priest, telling him, the life of God in the soul is hope. And the more you hope, the more the divine life you contain within yourself. And since divine life contains power, wisdom, fortitude, and love, the soul feels herself as though being watered by as many streams for as many as are the divine virtues. And so the divine life keeps growing within you. But if you do not hope, that means reach out to God for his divine life and reach out for everything he wants to give us. If you do not hope, both in spiritual things and through the spiritual, the corporal too will participate. The divine life will gradually be consumed until it's completely extinguished. Therefore, hope, hope always. So I want to give you a number of scriptures, not exhausting the scriptures at all, on the subject of hope. Psalm 16, verse 9. Psalm 31, verse 24. Psalm 33, verses 18 and 22. Psalm 38, verse 15. Psalm 39, verse 7. Psalm 43, verse 5. Psalm 71, verses 5 and 14. And Psalm 119, verse 81. You can see, therefore, that this teaching on hope is all over the Psalter. Then Louisa said, I was just barely able to receive communion, and afterwards I found myself outside of myself in an out-of-the-body experience. And I saw three men in the shape of three untamed horses raging throughout Europe, making a great bloody slaughter. Well, other prophets, not coming from the church, but mainly outside of it, have called Hitler, Stalin and Mussolini the great three great stooges of Europe. They weren't the only untamed horses destroying Europe, of course. So these are the three untamed horses raging throughout Europe, making a great bloody slaughter. It seemed that they wanted to ensnare most of Europe in fierce wars, as though inside a net. All were trembling at the sight of these incarnate devils, and many were destroyed by them. So, May the 1st, 1904. The eye that delights only in the things of heaven has the power of seeing Jesus. As I was in my usual state, I was thinking about our Lord at the moment when, as he reached the top of Mount Calvary, he was completely stripped and was embittered with gall. And I was praying to him, saying, My adorable Lord, I see in you but a garment of blood adorned with wounds. For taste and pleasure I see bitterness and gall. For honour and glory I see confusion, opprobrium and crosses. Oh, please do not permit that after you have suffered so much, that I look at the things of the earth as anything other than dung and mud, and that I take any other pleasure but in you alone, and that all my honour be anything less but the cross. And he, making himself seen, told me, My daughter, if you did otherwise, you would lose the purity of eye that sees God. That's Matthew 5:8. And a veil would form over your sight, that is spiritual blindness, and you would lose the good of seeing me. In fact, the eye that delights only in the things of heaven has the power of seeing me. That's your Matthew 5:8 again. While one who delights in the things of the earth has the power of seeing only the things of the earth, because his eye, in seeing them as different from what they actually are, sees and loves them. Now, seeing the earth different from what they are, in other words, you're not seeing them with your proper sight. You're not seeing through the ephemeral nature of this low world. And so we go seeking stuff that's no use to us. So I want to give you 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 4 to 16. May the 28th, 1904. This is, I have a VIP on this one. Mortification knocks everything down and immolates everything to God. So this is the spiritual warfare that must actually go on inside of us. And if it doesn't go on inside of us, we're not laying the self aside to let the divine will take over. And if we don't do it, no matter what we read, no matter what we study, no matter what we say, nothing's going to happen because we have to do this. This is essential to the divine will spirituality that we put ourselves aside. So continue in my usual state, Louisa said, and with the highest bitterness because of the continuous privations of my adorable Jesus. He made himself seen for just a little, telling me, my daughter, the first bomb which must be primed in the interior of the soul is mortification. Isn't it interesting that Jesus speaks of a bomb when the secular world were preparing terrible bombs for the First World War? When this bomb is thrown into the soul, it knocks everything down and immolates everything to God, just as the bombs of war knocks everything down and destroys everything, immolating it to Satan, really. In fact, in the soul, it is as though there were many palaces, but all full of vices such as pride and disobedience, along with many other vices, and the bomb of mortification knocking everything down rebuilds as many other palaces of virtues, immolating them and sacrificing them all to the glory of God. So put Galatians 2:20 there. And also Isaiah chapter 2, where the prophet says a number of times, 6 or 7 times in the chapter, that the pride of man has to be brought low if God is to reign. The prophets of Israel were completely clear about what needed to happen. So Jesus says in this first paragraph that we must use mortification on ourselves. A little later, the devil came, Louisa said, who just wanted to molest me. And I, without becoming fearful, said to him, why do you want to molest me? If you want to show how brave you are, take a rod and beat me up to the point of leaving me not even one drop of blood, provided, however, that each drop of blood I shed be one more proof of love, reparation and of glory that I intend to give to God. Well, Satan's not going to do that. Satan only wants you to spill your blood or whatever else for his glory. And if you're going to do it for the glory of God, he's not interested at all. So Satan said, I don't have a rod with me to be able to beat you. And if I go and fetch it, you won't wait for me. And Louisa said, go ahead, I'll be waiting for you here. So he went off and I remained with the firm intention of waiting for him. This is utterly amazing if you remember how frightened she was in volume one with the first attacks of the devil. And you can see that as we grow spiritually, the Lord gives you bravery and understanding so that you know how to deal with this stuff. So the devil went off and I remained with the firm intention of waiting for him. But to my surprise, I saw that as he met with another demon, the two were saying it's useless for us to go back. Why should we beat her if this must serve to harm us and be a loss for us? It's good to make someone suffer who does not want to suffer, because then they would offend God, and that would be an advantage for Satan. But if one wants to suffer, we could harm ourselves with our own hands, and they didn't come back. And Louisa said, I was left mortified. In other words, she wanted to give God this glory, and the devils wouldn't give her the chance. It's a wonderful moment. So May 30th, 1904. The passion serves as a garment for man. Pride transforms the images of God into demons. Okay. And we have to remember that it was pride that made the most glorious and most highly placed angel in heaven into a demon. So, finding myself in my usual state, Louisa said, I was thinking about and offering the passion of our Lord, especially the crown of thorns. And I was praying that he would give me light, would give light to so many blinded minds, and that he would make himself known, because it is impossible to know you and not love you. You can see that the people who have walked away from the Lord today, they couldn't have known him. If they had known him, they would have remained and they would have loved him. It wouldn't have been possible for Judas Iscariot to do the terrible thing of betraying Jesus if he had loved him. We know that at the beginning of the ministry of Jesus, Peter was a very weak man and failed Jesus many times, but he loved Jesus. And it was because he loved Jesus that Peter could recover and Peter could become a saint. And the same is true for us. So Louisa said, it's impossible to know Jesus and not love him. While I was saying this, my adorable Jesus came out from within my interior and he told me, my daughter, how much ruin pride causes in souls. It brought down one third of the angelic host. And so when you list the seven deadly sins, pride is always the first one, because it's the great wall that we build up between ourselves and God. And if pride is there, of course, Satan has plenty of room to interfere and to rule a life. Pride, how much ruin pride causes in souls. It's enough to tell you that it forms a wall of division between the creature and God. And from images of me, it transforms them into demons, just as it did with the angelic host. And then, if the fact that creatures are so blinded that they themselves do not understand nor see the abyss that they are in, if that grieves you and saddens you so much, and you take so much to heart that I help them, my passion serves as a garment for man, which covers his great miseries, embellishes him, and gives back to him all the good of which he had deprived himself and had lost because of sin. And so I gave the passion to you as a gift, that you may use it for yourself and for whomever you want. Now, first of all, you hear that pride is what brought down the angelic hosts, and pride is what brought down the human race. When you examine the passion of Jesus, you are looking at the most astonishing, unreachable, inexplicable humility of the Son of God on the earth. He could have wiped all of these people out in just a flash, in a moment. And yet he took all the abuse that was given to him. And by his humility, he crushed the pride that was crushing the human race. So we only have to move into his humility and into his loving sacrifice in order to take all his merits to ourselves and to benefit from it and crush the pride out of ourselves and grow in humility. On hearing this, Louisa said, a great fear came to me in seeing the greatness of the gift, fearing that I might not be capable of using this gift and therefore I might displease the giver. And so I said, Lord, I don't feel the strength to accept such a gift. I am too unworthy of such a favour. It is better that you keep it, for you are everything and you know everything and you know to whom it is necessary and appropriate to apply this garment so precious and of immense value. And I, poor one, what can I know? And if it is necessary to apply it to someone and I do not do it, what strict account would you not ask of me? Beside that, I want you to put Ezekiel chapter 16, where the Lord told the prophet that if he actually told the people their sinfulness, then they themselves were responsible before God. But if he didn't, God would hold him responsible. And that's what Louisa is thinking about. So she couldn't take this responsibility. And Jesus said, do not fear, for the giver himself will give you the grace, that is the power, the enabling power, not to keep the gift that he has given you as useless. So beside that, I want you to put the parable of the talents in Matthew 25, verses 14 to 30, because there was judgment for the ones who did not actually produce anything from the gift that was given to them. And so that's why Louisa was nervous. Can you believe that I that I would give you a gift to do you harm, never, Jesus said. I did not know what to answer, Louisa replied, but I remained frightened and suspended, intending to hear what Lady Obedience thought about it. In other words, she wasn't going to just take this as offered, she was going to take it to the priest and get discernment about it. It is understood, however, that this garment wants to signify nothing other than all that the Lord operated, earned and suffered. In other words, that this garment contains his infinite merits for every single thought, word, deed and omission of his passion, in which the human creature or the soul finds the garment to cover her nakedness stripped of virtues, and finds richness with which to enrich herself, beauties to render herself beautiful and to embellish herself, and the remedy for all her evils. Then as I told this to the priest, he told me that I should accept. Okay, so now the Lord has offered and the church has discerned it, and the church says, yes, you go ahead with this. So June the 3rd, 1904, I have a VIP on this one as well. The cross destroys three evil kingdoms and constitute three good kingdoms in the soul. Okay. So here we have the power and the value of the cross. This morning, since Blessed Jesus was not coming, I felt all oppressed and tired. Then when he came, he told me, my daughter, do not want to become tired in suffering. In other words, don't actually put your will into this, but rather act as if at each hour you were just beginning to suffer. Therefore, Jesus is talking about us practicing the present moment. Stay in the moment. Don't go into the future. Don't go into the past. As we shift into the future or the past, we don't have any grace. God is only in the present. When he was asked who he was, he said, I am. He did not say I was. And he did not say I will be. He simply said, I am. So in the present moment with the Lord, we have everything we need. And no matter how great the crisis is, the smallest prayer you can say to him is, Lord, this moment and you, in your divine will. So he said, don't get tired. Act as if this was the very beginning. In fact, if the soul lets herself be dominated by the cross destroys three evil kingdoms in her, which are the world, the flesh, and the devil. Now, if these three evil kingdoms are not actually destroyed, we'll end up with a long purgatory if we get there. And it constitutes in her three good kingdoms, the spiritual, the divine, and the eternal. We start with the spiritual, we go on to the divine in the divine will, and then we go into the eternal will of God. So to overcome the world, the flesh, and the devil, he wants us to enter into the spiritual, the divine, and the eternal. So June the 6th, 1904. It takes courage, fidelity, and the greatest attention to follow what the divinity operates in us. Now this, you have to put a VIP on this one as well. And we need to give it a lot of consideration. It takes courage, fidelity, and the greatest attention. So you keep on hearing Jesus saying to Louisa, be attentive. Don't let your attention be scattered. Continuing in my usual state, Louisa said, Jesus made himself seen for just a little from within my interior. First himself alone, and then all three divine persons. Now, you can't have a privilege greater than this. It's just a totally astounding. But they were all in profound silence. Now, this is the message you're going to get here. And that is the message that interiorly we have to be silent. Now, the problem is that if our eyes are saturated with television and with our gadgets, and our ears are saturated with the noise of the radio and with music and all the rest of it. There's no way we have enough space in our interior to touch this silence and therefore touch the essence of God. And we're denying ourselves an absolutely extraordinary grace. It's really sad. So they were all in profound silence. I continued my usual interior work in their presence, and it seemed that the sun would unite with me and I would do nothing but follow him. But everything was silence. And in this silence, I would do nothing but identify myself with God. That's true contemplation now. And my whole interior, my affections, my heartbeats, my desires, my breaths, they would become profound adorations to the Supreme Majesty. Look how simple prayer is. That all you do is go into the depths of your being, and in that silence, let everything in you, every atom and molecule of your being, be in adoration of the profound mystery of the Blessed Trinity, three persons in one. Adoring them, praising them, blessing them. But you do have to actually recollect yourself. Then after spending some time in this state, it seemed that all three of them were speaking, that is, communicating. Though one single voice was formed. Now, if you go to Genesis chapter 18, where the three angels came to Abraham, he saw them as three men initially. When he started communicating, there was only one voice, and he began to realize and use the expression, the Lord. So there was one voice. And they said to me, our beloved daughter, courage, fidelity, and greatest attention in following what the divinity operates in you. Because everything you do, it is not you who does it. For you do nothing other than give the divinity your soul as a residence. This is extremely important. All we can do is give our soul and give our spirit, give our heart, give our mind, give our bodies to God, and then he will do everything else. We give him a temple on the earth, 1 Corinthians 3:16. We give him a Bethany where he can go. We give him a manger in Bethlehem for him to be born on this earth. We give him a place. And it's incredible that we ourselves become the temple. We become the Holy of Holies because he is within us. Okay. He said, everything you do, it's not you that does it, for you are nothing other than give the divinity your soul as a residence. So I want to give you Galatians 2:20 there. That I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. It's the same with you as with a poor woman who had a little hovel, and the king asks for it as his residence. And she gives it to him and does everything the king wants. Now, if you go back to 1 Kings 17, from verses 7 to 24, you get the story of the widow of Zarephath, who's a poor widow, who gave hospitality to God's messenger, Elijah. And then the wonderful things that happened in her house and to herself and her son, simply because she actually gave a residence to God's prophet and therefore to God himself. So the king asks for it as his residence. And she gives it to him and does everything that the king wants. So, since the king resides in that little hovel, it contains riches, nobility, glory, and all goods. But to whom do they belong? They belong to the king. And if the king wants to leave, what remains for the poor one? Nothing. She's left with her poverty. So there you have John 15:5. Without me, you can do nothing. Okay. You have another story of the poor woman who received the prophet in the woman of Shunem in 2 Kings 4, verses 8 to 37. Okay. I want to go back to something and just underline it. She said that when she went into this adoring silence, she said, everything was silence. And in this silence, I would do nothing but identify myself with God, and my whole interior, my affections, heartbeats and desires and breaths would become profound adorations. So what she does is that she looks at what Jesus is doing. She repeats it and she echoes it. That's what we have to do as well. And why we're given the life of Christ and the passion of Christ to look at, so that we see all his actions and his intentions. So June the 10th, 1904. I have a VIP on this one as well. And the heading that I would give to this is, if only we realized who we are in God's presence. The heading is the beauty of man and his blindness with regard to himself. See, one of the things that sin and Satan and the world do is gives you a completely false image of yourself. And we live out of that falseness and produce nothing but disaster. Continuing my usual state, Louisa said, my adorable Jesus came for just a little, all sad and sorrowful. And he told me, ah, my daughter, if man but knew himself, oh, how careful he would be not to become stained. In fact, his beauty, his nobility, his strikingness are such and so great that he encompasses all the beauties and varieties of created things within himself. Throughout these writings, Jesus refers to the human race, man, as his beautiful, precious jewel. In fact, his beauty, his nobility, his strikingness are such and so great that he encompasses all the beauties and varieties of created things within himself. And this, because all other things of nature had been created to serve man. You find that in Genesis chapter 2. Everything was made for him. And when everything was made, then Adam was put into this magnificent place to live. And man was to be superior to all of them. In Genesis chapter 2, you hear him naming all the different species of animals, for example. And so in order to be superior, he had to encompass all the qualities of the other things within himself. Not only this, but since the other things had been created for man, and man was created for God alone and for his delight, as a consequence, he was not only to encompass all creation within himself, but he was to surpass it to the point of receiving the image of the supreme majesty within himself. That's Genesis 1:27. So I want to give you Psalm 8. On the one hand, we're nothing, and yet in God's eyes, we're utterly precious. In this psalm, the psalmist says, Lord, what is man that you would care for him, that you would give him even a thought? You've made the whole universe just with the tips of your fingers, with your voice. And yet you made man little less than a god. With glory and honour you crowned him and gave him power over the works of your hands. That's the great mystery, that on the one hand we're nothing, and then on the other, in God's eyes, we're very precious because we are his creation and he loves his creation. But in spite of this, and heedless of all these goods, man does nothing but dirty himself with the ugliest filth, that is, with the most base sins. And you have to go to John 8:44, where Jesus says that anyone who sins is a slave, and that we come under the paternity of the author of slavery, which is Satan. Okay. Louisa said, I understood that it happens. Wait a minute now. Louisa said, I understood that it happens to us in the same way as to a poor woman who received a garment woven with gold and enriched with gems and precious pearls. But since she knows little about these things and does not know their value, she keeps the garment exposed to dust, gets contaminated. She easily lets it get dirtied with mud, and she holds it as if it were a rough and inexpensive dress. So much so that if it is taken away from her, she suffers little. Such is the blindness that we have with regard to ourselves. So we have been given the garment of grace and salvation. We have been given the inestimable privilege of the image of God within us. And we have been given the incredible treasure of the whole passion of Jesus and his cross, so that we can become as rich as we want spiritually. So June 5th, 1504. The creature is nothing but a little container filled with a dose of divine particles. So I want you to put a heading on this one. Who are you? The little creature is nothing but a container filled with a dose of divine particles. As I was in my usual state, Louisa said, Jesus came for just a little and he told me, my beloved daughter, the human creature is so dear to me and I love her so much that if she could understand it, her heart would burst with love. Our Lady said something like that in Medjugorje as well. She said, you would weep if you understood how much I love you. This is so true that in creating the soul, I made her as nothing but a little container filled with a dose of all the divine particles in such a way that of all of my being, attributes, virtues and perfections, the soul contains many little particles according to the capacity given to her by me. John 1, 16 to 17. And this, so that I might find in her as many little notes corresponding to my notes, and thus be able to delight perfectly and to play with her. Now notice, play comes in very frequently when the Lord is speaking about his relationship with us. I want you to put Proverbs 8:31. The Lord delights to be with the children of men. Most of us don't have an image of God as one who wants to play with us. Our image is mostly that if you don't toe the line that you'll be punished, which is very much a Mount Sinai Old Testament image of God. Not one where he delights to be with us. Now, when the soul deals with material things and lets them enter into this little container filled with the divine, something of the divine flows outside. In other words, if I have this cup and it is already full of water and I want to put something else into it, I have to pour the water out. Now, if I put something solid into this cup that already contains water, well, some of the water corresponding to the volume of the solid that I have put in will flow out. So Jesus says, the more you fill yourselves with earthly things and with self and with sin and all the rest of it, the more the divine flows out of you. We need to give that a deep consideration. So the more the earthly things enters in and you let them fill this little container, something of the divine flows out of it and something of matter enters to take its place. What affront the divinity received, and what harm to the soul. How much attention it takes so as not to let material things enter inside. Now, we need to use material things because that's on the earth, okay? But we must make sure that they're kept in their own place. you must not let material things enter inside if by necessity you have to deal with them. You, my daughter, be attentive. Otherwise, if I see anything which is not divine in you, I will not make myself seen anymore. So he's saying to us, this is a serious business. The decision is on your side. You can have as much of God as you want. You can open yourself up as much as you want to God. God is not going to force you. Satan will try to prevent it, but the decision is entirely in your court. If I don't want to be a teacher, I will not go through all the hassle of becoming a teacher. If I don't want to be something, I just won't go through the process. So you have to want it. I will never become a saint unless I want it. And if I want it, I will allow the Lord to purify me and to enable me to empty myself more and more and more so that he can fill me with himself and allow me to become what I want. But I have to go through this process. So we have to look at something here, and that is that if you fill the soul with the divine, it empties the soul of the material. But if you fill the soul with the material, you empty it of the divine. So you have to ask the question, who or what possesses my soul? Who is master and Lord? Now, in the days of charismatic renewal, we sang, he is Lord, he is Lord, and reign in me, Lord, reign in me. But we have to actually allow the Lord to reign in us by giving him the space. So June the 17th, 1904. The consummation of the human will in the divine renders the soul one with God and places the divine power in our hands. So this is a very important one as well. Put your VIP on it. Not that they're not all important, but some of them just seem to stand out as something that demands a real decision on our part. Louisa said, this morning after I struggled very much, Blessed Jesus came and told me, my daughter, see how many things are said about virtue, about perfection, but they all end up in one single point. That is, in the consummation of the human will in the divine. In other words, what we're getting here, and this is a VIP one multiplied by 1,000, okay? What we're being told here is that the essence of living in the divine will is that the human will must surrender. And that's that. If the human will doesn't surrender, the divine will cannot take over. It's as simple as that. And the more we hand over the divine will, the more divine will we receive. When we hand over the final bit, then the divine will actually takes over. So the more one is consumed in divine will, the more it can be said that he contains everything and is more perfect than everyone, because the culmination of life, of perfection, is that the divine will takes over from the human. In fact, all virtues and good works are many keys that open up the divine treasures and make one acquire more friendship, more intimacy, and more commerce with God. But consummation alone is what renders the soul one with him and places the divine power in her hands. Okay, let's read that again, just to make sure you actually get it. In fact, all the virtues and good works are many keys that open up the divine treasures and make one acquire more friendship, more intimacy, and more communion with God. But consummation alone, that means the absolute surrender of the human will, is what renders the soul one with God and places the divine power in her hands. And this, because life must have a will in order to live, and by living of the divine will, one naturally takes ownership. Okay, so here you will put Galatians 2:20, I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. So June the 19th, 1904, sorrowful times for the church, the glory of the athletic spirits. These are the people who will really make an effort in the spiritual life. As I was in my usual state, Louisa said, I felt my adorable Jesus near me, saying, "My daughter, what a sorrowful stage the church is about to enter." A century later, we are the ones who know what he was talking about and what a sorrowful state we've arrived in. But all the glory of these times belongs to those athletic spirits who, heedless of shackles, chains and pains, do nothing but break the thorny path that divides society from God. Now, this is 1904. The very first place that was conquered by communism was Russia, and then its satellite states. And the utter unbelievable disaster that happened there, and the destruction of the Christianity there. And what came out of it was literally millions of martyrs. One by one, the people stood up against that horrible evil. And regardless of the amount of imprisonment, enchainment, torture, death, everything, they stood for Christ. And when communism fell without a shot being fired at it in 1989, the very first thing the people did was to pick up the cross and put it back on their churches. So that's what Jesus is talking about here. What a terrible time is coming for the church. But all the glory of these times belongs to those athletic spirits who, heedless of shackles, chains and pains, do nothing but break the thorny path that divides the society from God. And then he added, "One can see greed for human blood in man," he said. "He from the earth, and I will concur from heaven with earthquakes, fires, hurricanes, calamities, such as to make the good part of them die." Okay, first of all, I want to give you Amos 3:7, that the Lord never does anything without telling the prophets first. Secondly, I want you to remember Pope Leo XIII's vision, in which Satan asked for 100 years to destroy the church, and he's done pretty well. That 100 years was the 20th century. What Satan actually did was the infiltration of the church through communism and then later through the Freemasons. And they've done horrible damage to the church. towards the end of the 20th century, the Daily Mail had a tiny little notice in it, and it said that for every decade of the 20th century, disasters increased in number and in ferocity. Now, this was an ordinary publication, an ordinary newspaper. It wasn't to do anything to do with Christianity. And they were able to see that for every single decade of the 20th century, that the chastisements of God increased in number and in ferocity, to see would the human race change. Have we changed? No. We also know now that the 20th century produced more martyrs for Christ than the 19 centuries leading up to it put together. So, June the 20th, 1904. Victim souls are the daughters of mercy. In order to help the human race to try and survive and to try and respond to God, what the Lord does is that he sends victim souls to come in and to stand between the justice of God and the sinfulness of man. "After I struggled very much," Louisa said, "Blessed Jesus came for just a little and he told me, 'My daughter, human perfidy,'" that's perverseness. And Jeremiah chapter 17, I forget the verse at this moment, said that the human heart is perverse. "Human perfidy has reached such a point as to exhaust my mercy on its part." Whoops. "And my goodness is so great as to constitute daughters of mercy." Many of these victim souls are actually women, not men. "So that on the part of human creatures also, this attribute may not be exhausted." In other words, the victim souls will keep as much mercy on the earth as is possible during these terrible times. "These are the victim souls who are in full ownership of the divine will, having destroyed their own. In fact, in these souls, the container given by me in creating them is in full vigor. And since they have received the particle of my mercy, being daughters, they administer them to others. It is understood, however, that in order to be able to administer a particle of my mercy to others, they themselves must be in justice. In other words, these brave souls stand in the breach and they take divine justice upon themselves to earn divine mercy for us who don't deserve it. And that is the extraordinary calling of a victim soul. Louisa said, "Lord, who can ever be in justice?" And he said, "One who does not commit grave sins and abstains from committing even the slightest venial sins of his own will." Now, here he tells you the standard required of a person in Louisa's position. If she is to have power with God, there cannot even be a shadow of sin near her. Not even a shadow. Look at the standard. So we must be very careful to go to war against even the smallest sins in our lives. So June the 29th, 1904, the sign that you would know when God withdraws from the soul. This is very important, okay? "This morning," Louisa said, "as I was in my usual state, my adorable Jesus made himself seen for just a little. And he told me, 'My daughter, the sign whereby you would know when my justice can no longer bear man is in the act of sending grave chastisements,' because grave chastisements are only sent for grave situations. And the sign is that man can no longer bear himself. That's why we go to war. We can't bear others. We can't bear ourselves. We can't bear our situation. In fact, rejected by man, God withdraws from him and makes him feel all the weight of his nature and of sin and of miseries. And man, unable to bear the weight of his nature without divine help, seeks himself the way to destroy himself." He said, "That is the state of the present generation." That was only 1904. I can't imagine what he would say about our situation a century later. For that, I want to give you Ezekiel 10 and 11, where Ezekiel, the prophet, saw the Spirit of God rise up from the temple, hover over the temple because that had been his home, and then leave because of the sins of the people. But in that situation, the people repented. So he came back in chapter 11. If you go to Romans chapter 1, Paul is speaking about the Roman Empire at the time of the early church, which was absolutely rotten in stink. And he says three times that God abandoned them to their vile behavior and to their unnatural relationships. Also, when human beings can no longer bear themselves, you have a huge rise in suicide. In other words, people become their own executioners. But they also become murderers as well as suicides. Sometimes they kill their families before they kill themselves. So I've said to you before, and I'll repeat it again, that sin rises up to God from the human race, but nothing unholy or unworthy can enter the presence of God. So sin is sent right back to us as chastisements. And so we actually bring all these disasters upon ourselves. So July the 14th, 1904. "Life is a continuous consummation. Louisa said, 'My days are becoming more and more sorrowful because of the almost continuous privations of my adorable Jesus.'" Louisa, you see, has to live like the rest of us, that the just man lives by faith. But she has had such extraordinary experience of seeing the Lord that this living in the darkness of faith is intolerable for her. "I myself do not know why I feel my soul and also my body being devoured by this separation. What a consuming torment. My only and sole comfort is the will of God, because if I have lost everything and also Jesus, this holy and most sweet will of God alone is in my power, she says. Now, if you have followed the messages immediately before this, the divine will not be in your power until you have surrendered the human will completely and totally. It's at that point the divine will comes to you and you have the divine will in your power. Also feeling that my body too is being devoured, I flatter myself that it will not take long for it to melt because I see that and that I feel it succumb. And therefore, I hope that one day or another, the Lord may call me to himself and end this hard separation. Poor Louisa, she's another 30 volumes to do. But I want to give you Psalm 22, verse 14, where Christ on the cross says that I feel my whole being pouring out like water. I feel I'm disintegrating. Then this morning, after much struggling, Louisa says, oh, how much. He came for just a little and he told me, my daughter, life is a continuous consummation. Some consume it for pleasures. Some consume it for other creatures. Some for sin. Some consume it for interests, idols, whims, whatever. There are many kinds of consummation. Now, one who forms this consummation all in God can say with all certainty, Lord, my life has been consumed with love for you. And I have not only consumed myself, but I have died for love of you alone. Therefore, if you feel yourself being consumed continuously because of my separation, you can say that you are dying continuously in me. And that you suffer many deaths for love of me. And if you consume your being for me as great as the consummation of yourself is, so much do you acquire of the divine within yourself. Now, I've given you this before, that our God is a consuming fire. That's Hebrews 12, 29. In Exodus chapter 3, verses 1 to 10, the very first image of God that Moses got was a consuming fire that didn't actually destroy. And so for Moses and those in the Old Testament, it was the fire of God's judgment or God's wrath. In the New Testament, it's the fire of God's love, but it still consumes, it absorbs, it takes everything. So I also want to give you Psalm 6, verse 7, and Psalm 31, verses 9 to 10. So July the 22nd, 1904, only stability is what reveals the progress of divine life in the soul. Now, this is extremely important. What the Lord is saying here is that if you're in and out of the divine will, there's no stability there. And if there's no stability, then you're not going to gain a lot because you're going to lose what you gain. And so it's when you give on a moment by moment, hour by hour, day by day level that it becomes real, that it becomes stable, I should say. Continuing my usual state, Louisa said, Blessed Jesus came for just a little. And he told me, my daughter, when the soul proposes either not to sin or to do some good, and she does not carry out the proposition she made, it's a sign that those things are not with all of her will. So in other words, if we don't do what we say, obviously our will isn't actually fully in it. And that the divine light has had no contact with that soul. So the divine power has not really connected with that soul. Otherwise we wouldn't behave like this. In fact, when her will is true, that means that what she says, she will do. And the divine light makes known to her the evil to be avoided or the good to be done. The soul hardly fails to execute what she has proposed. But in other words, when our will is stable and therefore we are letting the divine will come and empower us, then we can carry it out. So I want to give you there Ephesians 1, 17 to 19. On the other hand, when the divine light does not see stability in her will, now notice in these writings, the issue all the time is in your will, because that's what decides everything. It does not administer to her the necessary light in order to avoid something or to do something else. So if our wills are not stable and we are not therefore in a position to be able to receive this divine light, it's extremely sad. At most, there might be moments of misfortune, abandonments of people or some other circumstance such that it seems that the soul would want to undo herself for God and change her life. But as soon as the wind of the circumstances changes, immediately her human will changes. So here you have a situation described where a person wants to give themselves to God in circumstances that are difficult for them. But if the difficulty moves away, then they change their mind and they go back to the way they were. And the problem is instability. So instead of will and light, it can be said there is a mixture of passions, we would say emotions, and according to the changes of the winds. In other words, that's the way people are today in society. They're following their feelings. Everything is feeling this and feeling that and feeling the other. They're not following principles. They're not following divine law. They're just simply following the feelings of the body, which are very fragile, and they change so frequently that it means that there's nothing stable there. The house is built on sand. It's not built on rock. So I want to give you Matthew 11:7. You become a reed blowing in the wind. Stability alone is what reveals the progress of divine life within the soul, because since God is immutable, one who possesses him shares his immutability in good. Now, if divine will is really operating in us, we become more and more stable in good. That's just the way it is. So if a person is going with the flow in society, they're not with the divine will. If she is stable in her commitment to the Lord, yes, she is. And one of the things that a person growing in God actually shows is emotional control. I want to leave it there just for now.